I've included a reading list. Just wanted to say a word about that. Our Christian Perspectives on the Social Sciences. So I hope that's useful to you. I've grouped it into four different sections, actually. Introductory, intermediate, advanced, and then a final section. The introductory section I've described as undergraduate level. So that is, it doesn't mean it's only for undergraduates, because I know you don't want to read undergraduate stuff anymore. But all of us sometimes need to go back to basics. And some of the texts there I would recommend in particular. I've starred the ones that I think are particularly useful on the social sciences. So don't be too proud. You can do it in private, reading these books. You don't have to let your friends know. And then intermediate, so senior undergraduate, postgraduate, just a range. This is not at all comprehensive. It's just illustrative of the kind of texts that I think are particularly useful in this field. And then advanced sort of postgraduate levels. And then there's a final section is what I call secular critiques of academic secularism. I mentioned yesterday that we should look at the postmodern turn positively in the first instance. And both those texts by William Connolly and Elizabeth Shackman Hurd, actually both political scientists, political theorists, are written by people who are deeply informed by postmodernism. This is where the internal academic critique of secularism is being developed in its most powerful form, or rather from these voices. Another one that I should have added is Charles Taylor's latest book, A Secular Age. He's a Christian, so he's not developing a secular critique of academic secularism. But if you've got a free summer and you want to plow through the 800 pages of that book, please do. If you haven't got a whole summer and you've only got a day or two, read chapter 15. Okay, that's all I'll say. Oh, well, let me say why. Because its title is The Imminent Frame. And it's a really fascinating and influential and important, I think it will be influential, account of what it's like to dwell in an imminent worldview. That is, a worldview which is fundamentally secular. And so he thinks his way into that position and tries to compare and contrast it with a more theistic worldview. And it's really a riveting discussion. At least I found it a riveting discussion. And I think it's the most important chapter in the book. In fact, there is a website discussing it at length, quite a high-level discussion. Not just any, Joe Bloggs can key in, vent their spleen and have it up for the world to see. It's filtered, so that the levels, the contributions are quite high level. But it's simply www.theimminentframe.com, and that's a fascinating high level debate among Christian secularists of all kinds. So that's just by way of reading, and I just want to wave a couple of, or one title actually, which is on that book, but which is very hard to get hold of. It's called Social Science in Christian Perspective, published about 10, 15 years ago. I don't know whether Richard has any copies available. It's hard to get, but it really gets down and dirty into the disciplinary detail of social sciences. It's written by sociologists, economists, political scientists, and others, and really gets into the sort of conceptual transformative project that I've been talking about. So, lots of other titles as well. Alright, well, let me first of all kind of explain the title here, Christian Faith and Social Sciences. It's a bit of an overblown title, because as I began to prepare the second lecture, I realised that it was probably better to stay at a fairly general interdisciplinary level rather than getting into too much detail about particular disciplines. I'm very glad Joanna did that very helpfully this morning, which is great, but I'm going to stay at a fairly sort of interdisciplinary level. So really the title should be Christian Scholarship Illustrated by the Social Sciences. Most of my illustrations are going to be drawn from the social sciences. And so I have a series of general points I want to explore with you about what Christian scholarship might look like, or what sort of broad considerations we should bring to bear when we think about what Christian scholarship means in social sciences or indeed other disciplines. I say other disciplines, what I say probably has less relevance to the natural sciences, I have to be honest about that, but hopefully you can fill in the blanks, and what Joanna said this morning was very helpful about that as well. So the first general claim is this, that a Christian perspective will seek to allow a Christian worldview to guide or frame the whole of a discipline's content. In other words, there aren't any areas of immunity, in principle immunity, from the transformative impact of a Christian perspective. We need to get away from the residual dualisms, perhaps the deep and persistent dualisms in our own disciplinary thinking, that there are certain areas of the field which lend themselves to Christian reflection and others which are just neutral or off limits or objective. So that's the starting claim I want to venture. Now, let's unpack that a bit further. It's often said that when you do that, that the Christian scholarship that emerges will be distinctively Christian. You've probably heard that phrase. I prefer to speak of authentically Christian scholarship rather than distinctively Christian scholarship. I want to explain what I mean in this first section. Well, to start off, if we want to allow our field of study to be penetrated by the shaping effect of a Christian worldview, we certainly should expect to see some difference in the fruits that we produce. You know, if after sinking years and years of energy individually and collectively into the project of Christian scholarship, and let's think idealistically, in a generation we have textbooks in every university written, in every discipline written by distinguished senior, you know, integrated Christian scholars. And if you can't see anything different at all what was all that about? Why did we go to all that trouble? So you would expect, surely, ultimately, to be able to discern some tangible difference in the fruits we produce. If the modern university has indeed, as Charles Malik suggested, as I quoted yesterday, has swerved from its foundation in Jesus Christ, then scholars who confess Jesus Christ as Lord will surely produce different products to those who do not. That's certainly his expectation in that book, which I would certainly recommend again, The Christian Critique of the University. So, I would say that Christians who are, for example, sociologists or economists, stick with sociologists for now, should indeed work over time towards the gradual development of something that we could call Christian sociology. That, I think, is a legitimate and even necessary aspiration, akin to what's already out there, motivated by secular worldviews, namely Marxist sociology, radical feminist sociology, deconstructionist sociology, functionalist sociology, and so forth. Remedying the deficit that George Marsden noted, I quoted from him yesterday, that there are no parallel schools of thought marked by a Christian worldview to range against these things. So that seems to me a legitimate and a necessary broad, communal, general aspiration. It's not the task of one scholar to do that. There will be some pioneers, some towering figures who, you know, blaze a trail, if God gives us those, and we'll be grateful for them when they appear. People like Alvin Plantinga in philosophy, for example. But, having said all that, it's important to be clear about what we should and should not expect under the heading of something like Christian sociology, Christian economics, Christian political science. On the one hand, we don't want to raise false ambitions about what Christians will or can achieve. I mean, this is true in Christian life in general, but it's also particularly true in the field of scholarship. If you have unrealistic expectations about what the final product of the Christian scholarly enterprise will look like, then you'll simply create a recipe for disappointment and cynicism. And there's evidence of this already out there. So those who have attempted to develop a Christian perspective in the social sciences, for example, have been criticised by sceptics who say, "Well, what's the difference? Right? You didn't, you know, I can't see any difference. It's just like what everybody else does." So we have to have measured and appropriate expectations. We don't want to raise false ambitions. But at the same time, neither do we want to underplay the potentially powerful and far-reaching impact of a Christian worldview in a particular discipline, and indeed in a particular research project, or the course of a life's research, let's say. And I think to speak of distinctively Christian scholarship can be easily misunderstood, because it seems to suggest that what Christians do or should produce in their academic field is different to secular scholarship visibly and comprehensively. That is, it should be different all the way down. But when we look at even the best examples, historically or in contemporary situation, of serious Christian scholarship, this is obviously not the case. So if you look at any of the books on my list, pointing to a Christian perspective in the social sciences, the subject matter you'll find there is, to a considerable degree, convergent with what you would find anywhere. It's not a different universe. It's the subject matter, these extensive overlap. But a colleague of mine who teaches law suggested that if he had the opportunity in his university to teach any typical course in law, whatever that might be, contract, tort, public law, etc., from a Christian perspective, the subject matter would be about 85% the same. He's that kind of a guy, you know, 85%. Lawyers, they like precision. 85% the same. Well, that's guesswork. I mean, it's a bit plucked out of the air. You know, I think I myself, if I were teaching a course, as I indeed have done, in say, Christian political theory, which is my area, it's not empirical, it's more theoretical, I'd go for a figure of about 60%. So we kind of haggle over that, according to the subject matter and so on and so forth. In the natural sciences, the figure might be even higher. I'm just thinking now, you know, your typical 12-week semester course, or your typical sort of 12-chapter basic textbook, the headings, the subject matter, is going to be considerably the same. And we shouldn't expect to, as it were, create a comprehensively novel and unheard-of set of subjects, topics, themes, problems, as a result of a Christian worldview. But this isn't surprising, and it's important to know why. The Christian sociologist, for example, studies the same reality as everyone else, the furniture of the social world, as it presents itself in a particular context, of course, a particular cultural, geographical, temporal context, social institutions, social change, the common realities of a shared social life, all kinds of social processes. These are the same, and so the object of study is the same, and therefore it's very likely that what Christians are going to come up with is going to look quite the same in terms of a shared subject matter. And it's common because, I would suggest, that the furniture of the social world reflects a common creation order in which humans exist and act. Christians confess that whatever deep divergences exist in fundamental worldviews, nevertheless, which cause us to perceive reality very, very differently, nevertheless, the reality we perceive is shared. It's the same order of creation. Well, why is that significant? I think it's important to emphasize that because often Christians speak about creation as if it were a kind of inert backdrop to the real action of the Christian life, or human life, actually. There's a kind of a neutral stage on which the action is played out, like the stage of a play. And therefore, whether or not you believe in the doctrine of creation isn't going to make much difference to where you work, where you live, what you believe, or how you interpret the world. But I don't think, I think biblically creation is depicted as something very different from that. It's much more a dynamic force field which actively, moment by moment, frames all human experience. So the fact that we are here situated in this room, sitting together, thinking, writing, reading, maybe sleeping now and again, these things are possible because God upholds the creation order in such a way as he has designed it to make this possible. You know, every breath you take is sustained by the Word of God and Christ as the Word. That's true for all human beings. And if we confess God, if we mean something serious by confessing God as Creator, that is, if we mean that God continually upholds and sustains and guides and pervades and underpins and nurtures and loves the creation order and human beings in it, then we have to believe that it is going to make a difference to scholarship, whether you're a Christian or not. So you could say that, you know, scholarship, whether it's done by Christians or not, is an attempt, as I said yesterday, to try to make sense of this dynamic, pulsating, splendid order of creation that God has given. And even those who do not believe in God, or who reject him, who believe all kinds of crazy things, still have to reckon with this same enveloping creation order. So the way then to read non-Christian scholarship is to ask the question, what does this scholarship reveal to us, even through distorted lenses, of the created order? And that means that we can start with a what you might call a presumptively generous attitude to non-Christian scholarship. The point of Christian scholarship is not to create, as I said yesterday, a sort of separate subcultural ghetto. Rather, it's to shed light on God's world. And that light comes through all kinds of sources. And predominantly today, it comes through non-Christian sources because they're in the overwhelming majority. So, we cannot avoid having to respond to the dynamics of created order in whatever particular department we're looking at. And the other thing to say on this is that creation order, because it's so pervasive and so impinging, it also frames not just the limits, not just the possibilities of experience, but also the range of interpretations of human experience. Now, that's not to suggest that there are not new ideas that emerge from all kinds of sources, certainly not. As you know, Joanna was using the phrase experimentation. Experimentation is a fundamental part of the human condition. It's actually a mandate of God to go out and find out what's out there. Find out new things. And that goes on all the time through history and will continue to go on. And I'd say, to anticipate an answer to one of the questions I posed in your pack, it'll continue in the new creation as well. Scholars won't hang up their library cards in the new creation. There will be libraries. You won't have to wait long for the books. You know, they'll come pretty quickly. There won't be fines because everybody will return their books on time. Unlike my son, I just got an email bill from Calvin College. He left with 10 books overdue, and there he owes about $25. But okay, so in the new creation, there won't be any library fines, but there will still be scholarship. Why would God, who has given us this amazing gift of scholarship, this amazing mandate to delve into the depths of his creation, at the climax of his redemptive work, say, sorry, I know that was great fun, but now you're going to leave all that behind, and I'm just going to infuse comprehensive knowledge into your brains like that? That would be an anti-creational thing to do. That would be very unexpected of God to do. Because redemption is the restoration, the renewal, the transformation, the elevation of every creational gift. But there'll also be football in the new creation. But Ronaldo will not get paid £80 million when he moves. In fact, will there be Ronaldos in the new creation? Well, let's not speculate about that. Thank you. There's another commercial. Great. So where was I? I'm having fun going off on a tangent here. So the point here is to suggest a methodological insight for engaging with non-Christian scholarship. First, we must expect non-Christians to discover true insights about God's creation. And it was intriguing to hear Joanna mention, what was that psychologist's name who came up with that definition of wisdom, the German? Right, yeah. I mean, you put that up against a biblical view of wisdom, and we shouldn't be shocked by that. Yeah? It's great when it happens, but we should expect that to happen. And That means we as Christians, particularly today, have to avoid all pride in approaching the work of non-Christians. Indeed, because of the current depleted state of Christian scholarship today, we must usually approach their work as learners long before we can be critics or teachers. Okay, that's my first general point. Second general point. Actually, no, before I move on, I had an example I wanted to give there. My talks are a bit sparse with examples, so here's one. So just a couple of examples of the sorts of insights that I myself have come to appreciate in mainstream secular social sciences. So, I mean, Marx's concept, for example, of the material base of society, right, his central insight that social institutions, political institutions, are fundamentally, overwhelmingly shaped by what's going on at the level of the economy and the power relations in the economy, it's a flawed view. It's been exposed as distorted in many ways, but that contribution has drawn the attention of modern social thinkers to the many ways in which economic processes do condition social and political institutions. They condition them, they don't determine them, but Marx's contribution has changed the nature of the discussion about the relationship between the polity and the economy. And Christians didn't invent that. They didn't get there first on that. You know, you can tell a story of Christian economic and political thought for the previous 1900 years up to Marx. All kinds of fascinating insights, anticipations of what later emerged in Marx. But Marx was the first one to try to put it all together in the context of a comprehensive theory. As I say, it's radically flawed, but nonetheless, it's changed the nature of the debate, and we have to learn from that. That's just one example. Another one is systems theory that was very popular in the social sciences in the 1960s and 70s. Any of you here who know the social sciences may well be aware of that. Anyway, systems theory has exercised an influence in many different disciplines, actually, but it was very popular in the 60s and 70s. And one of its related to structural functionalism as well. And one of the core concepts was the concept of social function. Now, I happen to think that structural functionalism and systems theory is skewed because it's essentially mechanistic in its understanding of the way social subsystems relate to each other. And that's not surprising because systems theory emerged, actually I'm not quite sure when, but decades before that, out of the discipline of cybernetics. That's where mechanism is a valid methodological approach. But you apply it to social subsystems, and it's quite seriously misleading. It's kind of deterministic, and produces bad predictions of how social relationships and institutions work. But nonetheless, the notion of a social function alerts us to the fact that every social institution, whether it's the family or even the church, well, no less the church, hospitals, universities, are situated in relation to, in multiple interrelationships with many, many other kinds of institutions. And these are reciprocal, these can be healthy, these can be dysfunctional. So this is a hugely important insight that, again, Christian social thought hadn't dreamt up itself. Now, I happen to think that if you then use the insights of Christian social thought, particularly, I found helpful, Catholic social thought, and a particular brand of Reformed social thought, Neo-Calvinist social thought, those two in particular have been very good at devising a theory of social institutions, a sort of Christianly inspired theory of social institutions. And so you can put the two together and try to integrate some of the best insights of structural functionalism with that more explicitly Christian approach, and I think that leads you to make progress and overcome some of the impasses that you find in that more mechanistic model. So those are just a couple of examples of how one ought to approach non-Christian scholarship. Second general theme: how, in more specific terms, might a Christian worldview shape the project of scholarship? Well, here I've got five major broad points to alert you to. Worldview awareness, historical awareness, normative awareness, alertness to reductionisms, and finally, attention to subject matter or questions neglected by the mainstream. Again, far from comprehensive, just some pegs to hang your thoughts around. So, first of all, worldview awareness. Christian scholars will, I suggest, be very conscious about trying to ferret out and identify the role of underlying worldviews in scholarship and in research. Now, this is somewhat less popular today because, you know, we're beyond the age of meta-narratives. Worldviews is another term for meta-narratives, you could say. So a lot of people shaped by postmodernism aren't particularly interested in this kind of work, and a lot of younger people today don't get it in the way that, you know, my generation did in the sort of 60s, 70s and so on, when there were people like Francis Schaeffer and James Thayer and all those people around who talked worldviewish type language. That's what I was schooled on. Today it's harder to get younger people, including Christians, to get into this. But I think here, you know, young people are just wrong about that. Right? They've got to get this right. They've got to do some more work on that. And I know you're still youngish, but I'm sure you're not guilty of this charge while you're here. So there's a problem in getting this point across to younger scholars, but I think it's just essential to do so. You know, the fundamental nature of theoretical work in universities has not changed in the last 30 years. And it's still essential to try to discern underlying worldviews. And worldviews is what you might call a comprehensive set of taken-for-granted presuppositions that are assumed by scholars. But equally important is to identify what you might call the sort of intermediate frameworks that actually impinge upon a discipline. So it's not going to get you very far just to say, there's a social theorist who's a secular humanist, red lights going on. That's not very interesting to say that. Right? You've got to say what kind of a secular humanist are they, what particular paradigms that reflect a modernist or a secularist or a materialist or a deconstructionist worldview is actually shaping their research and their output. So it's these intermediate theoretical paradigms that I think are particularly important to try to identify where we can. You know, we shouldn't sort of get too hung up on this and get paralyzed and, you know, get stuck in a rut saying, I can't go forward in dealing with this problem because I just cannot find the worldview that's driving everything. No, you can take this far too seriously, so don't let it paralyze you, but be on alert for it and go looking for it. What are these underlying worldviews and the paradigms that are shaping them? I mentioned a couple earlier, Marxism and systems theory and so on. And it's those paradigms that generate the fundamental concepts that actually drive and shape research. So in social theory, you know, for a long time the concept of class was determinative. It was sort of the fundamental origin concepts. Well, what is class? I mean, there are multiple conceptions of class. What conception of class is most conducive or most expressive of the distinctive concerns of a Christian worldview? That's no easy question to answer. There's no off-the-peg answer that you can just turn to. I'll quote later on another example from economics, the concept of the rational utility maximizer. One of these underlying taken-for-granted concepts that actually drives research. And I think a lot of people start their research careers as PhD students quite ignorant of these questions because the modern university does not train us to think about these things. In fact, it's got vested interests in us not finding out because there are all kinds of professional and institutional interests at stake. And, you know, if you smart aleck PhD student turn to your professor and say, there's a dubious concept underlying the research methodology that you're asking me to spend the next 3, 4, 5 years working on, and I'm unhappy with it, and, you know, I think we need to rethink this, that's threatening. On the individual level it's threatening, on the institutional level it's threatening. But it's a little easier to do that today because of the sort of loosening up that's taken place as a result of the impact of postmodernism. I think one particular way to try to alert ourselves to what I'm calling worldviews and paradigms is to, it may be too late at this stage, probably not actually, if you're beyond the level of coursework, you know, it might be technically too late, but to take courses, if they're offered in your department, in the philosophy of a discipline. So if you're doing maths, you know, the last thing mathematicians are interested in is the philosophy of mathematics. They just want to do sums. The last thing most economists are interested in is the philosophy of economics. In fact, that's a really slim discipline, showing the endemic resistance in economics to having those kinds of questions raised. More likely in social theory, there's all kinds of social philosophy out there. There's more than you can cope with, political philosophy as well. It'll differ from different disciplines. But also in the sciences, you know, most scientists hate the philosophy of the philosophy of science. Why? Because they think, if they thought about it, that they're naive positivists. You know, they kind of will give you a kind of naively positive answer to the question of how you approach your scientific methodology. In fact, no scientist is actually a positivist, because positivism doesn't work. You know, positivism is inaccurate as a description of how scientists work. Scientists discover things through things like guesswork, you know, imagination, kind of things that Joanna was mentioning, accident, you know, lateral thinking, having a dream one night. I mean, there are all kinds of non-scientific elements that go into the discovery of a scientific insight. And this is unsettling to scientists who like things tightly controlled, predictable, methodologically secure. But go for those courses. And, you know, if it's not too late, and don't be too proud at this stage, and you've got a year before you submit your PhD, go and sit with the undergraduates, incognito, you know, dressed down so nobody will notice you. You know, some giveaway, take your phone in so they know that they think you're, you know, kind of nice student. And take a course in, the philosophy of science or the philosophy of law or whatever it might be. It's notorious, actually, among lawyers that, you know, lawyers, the last thing they want to do is jurisprudence, philosophy of law. So I'd say Christians ought to be at the front of the row, the front seat in philosophy of law, soaking it in and taking it back to your study of the evolution of contract law in Germany between 1956 and 1957, you know, whatever it might be. Look for the connections. They might not be there, they might not be evident, but that's something that you should take seriously in mind. So that's worldview awareness and sort of awareness of paradigms. Secondly, historical awareness, and this flows from that point. Again, most students don't know about the history of the disciplines that they're working in. In fact, most academics don't know about the history because it's not a required part of the curriculum. We're all very modernist and progressivist. We know the last 10 years. We're schooled to immerse ourselves in the last 10 or so years of academic journals, and that's where we parachute in and we find a niche and we grab a problem, we get a methodology, we find a supervisor, and we're off and running. And we suffer from amnesia about where all these issues came from. Why are these issues on the table now? Right? There's nothing in the nature of things that has determined that the contemporary discipline of, I don't know, I'm just looking at agricultural economics or whatever, has the particular set of agenda items at the top of its agenda that it does. I mean, there are histories behind this, and so we need to dig into the historical origin and development of the disciplines. So, for example, in sociology, sociology was invented as a formal discipline in the late 19th century, turn of the century, by positivists. Comte, for example, was a radical positivist, not at all operating out of a Christian worldview, and that set the discipline off on a certain track which still shapes what goes on in the discipline today. So learn the history and have a degree of historical understanding, and you know, you can't maybe spend too much time on that while you're doing your PhD, but as you move into positions, academic positions, take time to learn that history and incorporate into your teaching. Teach your students to think historically. They won't like it, but then, you know, young people are wrong about so many things, and you've got to correct them. That's the basic. I have teenage kids, so, actually one's 21 next month, so. Thirdly, normative awareness. Normative awareness. Let me be quick here, because time is pressing on. I already referred to positivism as one of the problematic schools of thought and methodologies in social sciences. It's present in other areas as well. But even today, even though positivism as a philosophy of social science is basically discredited, I mean, philosophers of social science, none of them will defend positivism anymore. But it still kind of lurks around, and, you know, there's a kind of generational gap in the textbooks. So the academics discredit a theory, but the textbooks are out there, and the people who write the textbooks are essentially the teachers. And so they were taught 20 years ago. So there's a lag here. So you'll still find a fair bit of positivism in, you know, undergraduate or high school textbooks lurking around, even though it's formally disavowed by. The key problem with positivism is this bifurcation between values and facts, or norms and facts. Now, very quickly, there is a valid distinction between norms and facts. I don't go so far as the radical deconstructionists who say that facts are just constructed entirely and they're power moves. You know, claims to facts are just power moves by people with certain vested interests. You know, I think that argument. How shall I put this? I'm on tape. It self-destructs. Let me put it politely. It kind of self-destructs. It's too far-reaching. So there is a distinction between norms and facts, and we have to honour that distinction. But it's not a bifurcation. So the positivist view is that things are either facts or values. So if you're working in an empirical field, your task is to identify facts. To gather them together according to some technical methodology, to interpret them, to make empirical generalizations about them, to construct theories out of, you know, a series of empirical generalizations and so on. Values or norms don't enter into the process at all. Whereas what's now pretty widely recognized is that, let's think just about the social sciences, the human sciences now, facts are already laden with values and norms because the realities that a sociologist is actually examining are themselves normative. You know, human beings engage in normative behavior and normative thinking. That's one point. But secondly, no theorist approaches the study of any facet of reality, as I was saying earlier, divorced from certain prior normative commitments, usually hidden or concealed under this term concepts. Right? So remember, I had worldviews, paradigms, and then concepts. Concepts are often taken to be kind of equivalent to facts. They're sort of ideas, just presenting themselves without any inherent moral weight or value content at all. And I just think that's just mistaken. Go into that a bit later. That's pretty widely understood now, but Christians certainly should be among those who give a proper honouring of the normative character of the entire academic enterprise, and particularly in the social sciences. Okay, fourthly, and linked to this, an alertness to reductionisms. Joanna's point this morning was very helpful. I think what she described as assimilation to, this model of assimilation to, where, you know, in psychology, theology is reduced to psychology, is an obvious example of that. Technically, you can define reductionism as theories or methods which extends one type of causal explanation, which is quite legitimate in one area, to areas where it is incompetent. In other words, it's an exceeding of the bounds of the competence of a particular method or theory or type of causal explanation. It's the reduction of a phenomenon to merely one of its many dimensions. And this is, I think, the origin of many of the isms that come to dominate particular disciplines or particular corners of disciplines. Physicalism in the natural sciences, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but those who speak about the desire to find a theory of everything in sciences are essentially committing the physicalist fallacy, the idea that you can have a comprehensive physical explanation of everything in reality. It's just preposterous. I mean, a theory of everything? Sure, you can have a theory of everything physical, and that would be a physical theory. And let's root for that. So if somebody can come up with a physical theory of everything, everything physical, fine. I mean, there'll never be an end point to that, but certainly we should aspire to find comprehensive explanations of the physical world. That's what natural scientists do, but not a theory of everything else. That's just naked imperialism on the part of natural scientists. Materialism, idealism, evolutionism, economism, that's Marx's fault, historicism, the reducing everything to its temporality, right, to its historicity, on the assumption that nothing in reality is stable. There are no stable structures in the world, and so on and so forth. Many, many other isms. These are all examples of one or other kind of reductionism, a reduction of a phenomena to one of its dimensions. and let me throw this thought in here. Biblically, these reductionisms, I think, need to be related to Paul's teaching in Romans about the fundamental nature of idolatry. Now, it's not very wise, it's not very tactful to go around accusing your secular colleagues, you know, the historicists, the evolutionists of idolatry. There are certain prudential things that you need to avoid in talking to your colleagues. Don't accuse them of practicing idolatry. And I don't want to suggest that there's any immediate one-to-one connection between the fundamental human tendency to worship idols and one of these particular theoretical distortions. It's much more complicated than that. But in Romans chapter 1, you'll recall, Romans 2. Read the text. You're probably familiar with it. No, it is Romans 1. It's, won't read the whole passage, but it's 18 down to, around about 25. And the core insight here is that these people, namely those who have turned against God, have exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. That is, I think, the most fundamental and radical definition of idolatry. It's worshipping some aspect of the creation rather than worshipping God. In fact, there are only two options in worship. You either worship the creator or you worship some aspect of creation. As Bob Dylan so eloquently put it, you know, you've got to serve somebody. And that's true. The human instinct to worship has to find an outlet, and the human instinct, and that applies to scholars as well. Scholars need to find some reference point, some anchorage, some final explanatory account of what it is they're looking for. And if they don't have an integrated perspective in which God is at the center, then they will be tempted, let's say, to find it in some particular dimension of creation, and then use that one hook to try to explain everything else. That's what you might call an example of theoretical idolatry. Now, so the proper response to reductionism is not a rejection of the causal factor that's identified. So there are indeed multiple causal factors that are out there in the world, and that structure the creation order. So there are physical causes, there are indeed ideational causes, there are material causes, there are economic causes, there are biological causes, etc., etc. All of these are perfectly legitimate ways of explaining some aspect of creation, and we have to honour them all, and that's why we can learn from every example of theoretical idolatry. That's an example I've used of Marx earlier. You know, he, as it were, kind of committed theoretical idolatry by attributing, trying to explain the whole of human societies in terms of power relations between capitalists and proletarians. But we can learn from that mistake. There are insights to be gleaned even in those kinds of reductionism. And so I think, generally speaking, Christian scholars will, depending on your field, but will be inclined to, open to, looking for multi-causal analyses of whatever phenomena they're looking for. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be a kind of interdisciplinary expert. You have to gain expertise in 10 disciplines in order to study anything. No, but when you're studying one discipline or one particular type of causal explanation, you'll be alert to the relation between that type of causation and many others. Whereas those who do not are not on alert against reductionism will be less inclined to do that, ideally speaking. And here I think we should think about how we can develop a perspective that allows us to integrate multiple types of causation and avoid the kind of parallelism that Joanna was implying and criticizing earlier. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you should have a kind of multiple parallel, a model in which there are sort of multiple parallel factors that have no connection to each other, because they don't. They all interconnect. Physicality is a substratum of human emotion. And so, you know, somebody who's studying human emotion has to take into account the phenomena of physicality, et cetera, et cetera. You can I think, fill in the blanks there. And I think here I'd say the best model that I've come across, which provides a theoretical basis, a framework for integrating all these multiple analyses, has emerged out of the neo-Calvinist school of Christian philosophy, and particularly in the work of Hermann Dooyeweerd, which I'm just finishing a book on, his political thought. I find that model the most comprehensive and the most all-encompassing in its attempt to find a place for all of these multiple kinds of factors and to resist, therefore, reductionism in any discipline. Dooyeweerd himself is exceedingly difficult to read for all sorts of reasons. If you're interested in dipping in, the first text I'd recommend would be Roots of Western Culture. That's the most accessible, but it's pretty tough going anyway. But another book which gives an excellent account of a Dooyeweerdian framework is by Roy Clauser. It's called The Myth of Neutrality, and I think there are copies on the bookstall, so I'd certainly recommend that. Again, it's not an easy read, but it's definitely worth having a go at plowing through that. It provides a broad philosophical approach to this and other issues, and then gives some specific examples from particular disciplines. I think the ones he uses are mathematics, surprisingly. That's the one you'd least expect. Psychology. What else does he... Physics, yeah. So, in other words, he does take on some sort of hard disciplines. It's kind of easy in sociology, you could say, but you know, physics, psychology, mathematics. If you can make the argument stick there, then you know you've got somewhere. So that would be one broad suggestion for how to develop a kind of comprehensive, integrated model that honours all the different types of explanatory factor, and thereby, back of that, honours the many splendid wisdom of God in creation. That's what we're about, ultimately. Not dishonouring the complexity, the diversity, the differentiated, integrated character of the creation order. Fifth, how are we doing? Not very well, but we'll see how. Another 5 minutes, maybe. Attention to subject matter or research questions neglected by the mainstream. I was particularly struck by Joanna's comment there that, you know, it's on the edges of a field that often the new and creative insights are found. And that's really what I want to say. I don't need to say too much about that. There are many areas of study that are neglected by mainstream disciplines for all sorts of reasons, sort of blind spots. I mean, obviously, first one is religion. You know, religion has been systematically ignored in most of the social sciences until recently. Now, for example, in political science and international relations in particular, not surprisingly, it's everywhere. there is now a new subdiscipline that's emerged over the last 20 years, religion and politics, or politics and religion. It's political science catching up with sociology, which has been doing sociology of religion for more than a century. So that's good. There's even a newer discipline, apparently, subdiscipline, called the economics of religion, which looks at how religious institutions function economically. So this is all good. This is remedying an area that's been systematically neglected. But beyond that, and so it's not surprising, therefore, that Christian scholars will sort of gravitate towards that sort of problematic, because it's now beginning to be recognised in the secular academy. You know, you can talk religion and not feel ashamed and not feel as if you're stupid or eccentric. Not that that's the real goal, but it does help if people recognise what you're doing as a bona fide field of study. I mean, it's unavoidable now because religion is washing through every field of social life. It's just impossible to ignore. So that's good. But then beyond that, neglected groups in society, groups that are neglected by the academic mainstream. For example, again, political science is a good example. If you think about some of the most vulnerable groups in our society, the handicapped, the elderly infirm in particular, immigrants, asylum seekers, the unemployed, right? These are among the most vulnerable. There is not an extensive literature or great amount of attention in the political science discipline to these neglected groups. You know, political scientists tend to be a bit harder-nosed than sociologists. They tend to be disproportionately male, whereas, you know, sociologists is more even-handed, it's more female, just for whatever reasons. And so, you know, some hard-nosed male political scientists will tend to think, yeah, handicapped, elderly people, the girls can deal with that in sociology. Yeah. That's one of the kind of unstated assumptions, I think, that's out there. And it's fundamentally, well, it's not only bad scholarship, it sustains injustice. It sustains injustice, and Christians have to challenge that. And so maybe the calling of a Christian political scientist is to do a study of why elder care has not been given the attention it needs in the public policy process over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Christians are going to be on the lookout for those sort of neglected groups and give them a voice again where they need to be. Or, for example, you may correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me there isn't a huge amount of interest among secular sociologists about the children of divorced parents. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about family breakdown and everything, but what about, is there really enough research out there on the damaging impact of divorce on children? It's not a nice subject, right? Because a lot of secular sociologists are themselves divorced. I mean, it's like the media. The media don't know how to talk about divorce and family breakdown. And one of the reasons is that a lot of people in the media are themselves divorced. And it's uncomfortable. It's challenging. So Christians will want to, again, speak up for those kinds of voices that are neglected, and so on and so forth. And another example that I was glad that Joanna mentioned, neglected issues such as suffering. You mentioned suffering in psychology. And now, encouragingly, there are secular psychologists who are interested in that. That's something on which Christians might be expected to have some wisdom. And so we need to be looking out for those kinds of opportunities. So, those are just five very broad considerations to bear in mind, try to put a bit of flesh on what Christian scholarship might look like. These are concerns that will animate the Christian scholar in their work. I don't have time to say any more, except to summarise in 2 points the next two themes, 2 sentences. 3, a strategy of Christian scholarship is internal renewal, not external opposition. I think I've said enough to make that clear already. The idea is, let me give you an example here of what I think we should avoid. One of the leading social theologians of our time is John Milbank, who wrote a very influential book called Theology and Social Theory about 15, 20 years ago. It's a marvellous book, and it certainly generated some fascinating discussions. But it amounts to a kind of almost comprehensive rejection of almost the entire modern project of the social sciences. It's an example of actually of what Joanna called Assimilation One, where the social sciences are kind of overwhelmed by theology, and the social sciences look to simply to provide kind of analogies for theology or analogies about God. And although it's a marvellous work, I think it commits that fallacy, because it does not take seriously the need for internal critical engagement with the social sciences, the empirical social sciences, which of course is what Joanna was urging us to do in very helpful ways. So that's point three, that's all I'll say about that. Fourth, the ultimate goal of Christian scholarship is to serve humanity and not just satisfy intellectual curiosity. So, you know, yesterday, the one point I didn't discuss in my outline was what Christian scholarship is not, and that was really already answered in my subtitle. You know, it's not evangelism, it's not apologetics, it's not social action. It has its own distinctive integrity that we need to honour. And, well, now I don't want to sort of back away from that, but I want to contextualise that point by pointing out that although intellectual curiosity is essential for the scholar, if you don't have intellectual curiosity, quit now while you're ahead, because you won't make it through. You've got to have an inner drive, an inner hunger, an inner curiosity. You've got to be the sort of person that can sit in a library and wander around and put people, and just go on that voyage of discovery, not knowing where it'll end up, losing track of time. If you're not that kind of a person, then find a different profession. You know, you'll do better somewhere else. But if you are that kind of a person, then you're probably stuck with the life of scholarship. So, you know, make sure you can do it well. Nevertheless, how can this Christian scholarly calling contribute to the flourishing of other human callings? Let me put the question that way. It must contribute. It can't be separated from it. So I've said that Christian scholarship is not social action, and what I mean by that is that academic research in the social sciences, for example, shouldn't be dictated by the immediate needs of some campaign for social change. If that were the case, no one would do the kind of fundamental or the basic research on which applied research depends. And here, this is a particular temptation for evangelical Christians who, you know, we all have this activist bent, we want to get up and change the world immediately. You know, we don't like waiting for God's timing in the coming of the kingdom. We think the kingdom depends upon what we do tomorrow, next week, next year, you know, in the next 5 years. And so we're not very good at thinking long term. But at the same time, as Christian scholars, we do have opportunities and we do have responsibilities to contribute from the basis of our scholarly professionalism to wider society by, as I said yesterday, making ourselves professionally available alongside our scholarship to various community kinds of community service or social and political change. I think that's something which every Christian scholar should aspire to do, and in that sense I agree with Joanna that in some respects every Christian scholar should also be a practitioner of something. But also, even more importantly, I think we should allow our scholarship itself to acquire a critical edge, so that we don't, as it were, think we're changing the world in our spare time, but in scholarship we're just contemplating the world. No, our very contemplation of the world has to itself carry with it a kind of critical edge. And I simply summarise this as seeing our scholarship as working towards the exposure of what is dehumanising. That's not launching a campaign. That's not working for a think tank, although you might do that alongside. It's actually uncovering distortions, dehumanising distortions in any field, in our very scholarship, more obvious for some than for others, admittedly. In that sense, Christian social science should be a form of critical theory. To wrap up very quickly, conclusion. Try to suggest that Christian scholarship will be at least five things. It should be expressive of a biblical worldview. It should be authentically, if not distinctively, Christian. it should be supportive of and generative of non-reductionist paradigms. It should be critical, not conformist, and it should be offered in service to humanity. And so here, to give you something to chew on over lunch, is a rather convoluted attempt at a working definition of authentic Christian scholarship. And I'll just read that and then sit down. Start of a discussion. Authentic Christian scholarship is a transformational vocation to acquire critically oriented, systematic rational insight into and to disclose truth about some facet of created, fallen, and redeemed reality in the light of an intellectual framework responsive to the fullness of biblical revelation in critical dialogue with others and in service to humanity. And that's really a summary of what I've tried to do in these two lectures. Okay, sorry for going a little bit over time. Okay, all right. Let me stop there.